Sony's Columbia Pictures is the studio behind star-driven prestige dramas like Moneyball, Django Unchained, and American Hustle. But star-driven prestige dramas are not what they used to be. Even at $30 or $40 million, they're riskier and likelier to lose money than a $200 million superhero movie. An old-school drama requires nearly as much effort to develop, cast, produce, and market as a big franchise movie, but doesn't generate big returns in international markets or extra revenue from video game spin-offs and action figures. Sony missed the big jump to franchise hyperspace, as Ben Fritz documents in his new book, The Big Picture: The Fight for the Future of Movies. Fritz, who covers Hollywood for the Wall Street Journal, pored through the thousands of pages of the 2014 Sony hack, which included personal emails from top Sony executives, and adds a lot of his own reporting to show how Sony waited too long to follow Disney and Warner Brothers into the global franchise business. I read your book over the weekend, and the biggest thing that jumped out at me was former Sony studio chief Amy Pascal having a lot of typos and capitalization issues in her emails. Yes. I think that's probably what cost her the job. Would you say the typos?
The typos? No. I think after all those years, you were pretty used to the way Amy wrote and the way Amy spoke. So that was the least of her problems in the hack.
So the biggest through line of the book, to get a little more serious, is that Sony, one of the five or six biggest Hollywood studios, was still making dramas and spending way, way, way too much money on studio dramas at the time that all of the other studios were moving to franchises like the Avengers and Fast and Furious. Was the problem that Sony did not have those franchises or did not see what was happening or had its head buried in the sand about what was happening?
I think it's really the latter. Sony was not ready for it. And then once they realized that this change was happening and they needed franchises, then they felt they didn't have them, but it's because they didn't have any ready to go immediately. You know, if they had been playing this game from, 2008, they would have had more developed. They would have been prepared for this moment. So, they didn't have them, but the reason they didn't have them is they didn't take this trend seriously for far too long.
Well, and you have in the book basically all of their big franchises they've botched in one way or another over the last several years, from Men in Black with cost and creative problems, and James Bond with sort of more business corporate problems and the way that deal was structured, and then with Spider-Man, I guess what would you call the problem with Spider-Man? Part creative, part?
I would call it primarily creative. Yeah. I would call it primarily creative. The Amazing Spider-Man reboots were simply just not good enough for fans. Didn't stand up to the Marvel Studios movies, and the audiences, they rejected them. They were not nearly as successful as the ones with lesser known characters coming out from Marvel Studios.
I was surprised to read in the book that the deal between Marvel and Sony essentially allowed Sony to keep Spider-Man forever, as long as it made a new Spider-Man movie every, I think you said, 5 years and some months.
Yeah.
How is that even possible? I mean, how would anybody make a deal that didn't have an end date?
Well, it's a good question, but I mean, that's the only thing I can say for sure is when Sony and Marvel made that deal, Marvel was just out of bankruptcy. They were desperate for cash. I mean, I don't go into this in the book, but they were on the verge of bankruptcy again not long after. Like, they were in a terrible financial state. They had no leverage in that negotiation. So, Marvel, I think at the time they made that deal in the late 90s, never considered that they would be making their own movies, that they'd want these rights back. You know, they thought they'd always need a Hollywood studio to make the movies for them. So if you look at it from their perspective, they keep getting money. And if Sony keeps making movies, then Marvel keeps making more money. So all they cared about was somebody in Hollywood to keep making movies and therefore keep writing them checks to, to prop up their comic book and toy business. So from that perspective, it made sense. Obviously, once they started to realize they could make more money with movies themselves, it suddenly looked terrible.
Did the success of Spider-Man Homecoming work for Marvel and Sony the way they had hoped?
For Sony, definitely. Because Sony, the economics of that movie for Sony are the same as if they made it themselves, in that they keep 100% of the feature film profits. All, you know, they pay to make the movie, and they keep virtually, I mean, so like 99%+ of all the money the movie makes. So, and given that Homecoming was more successful than The Amazing Spider-Man 2 or 1 and cost less, that counts as a hit, and it was creatively well received. So they're well positioned to make sequels, including, you know, there's another one coming next year. So they're in a much better position than they were. So for them, big success. For Disney, I'd say it's a little more mixed for Disney. Creatively, it's good in that, you know, they really want Spider-Man to be a vibrant character. That's good for all their businesses. And, you know, he appears in Avengers as well as everything else. So the toy sales, I don't have the exact data, but I do, from what I can tell, I think the toy sales did okay, but I don't think quite as well as Disney hoped. But that's more of a toy industry problem. There's been a lot of movie licenses that have been a bit underwhelming recently, including Star Wars and Cars, and Spider-Man was part of that. So I think they would still say the better movie helped their toy sales, but they were probably hoping for a slightly bigger boost than they got.
As Sony was getting near the end of the Amy Pascal years, you have a chapter in the book about the Steve Jobs movie that, I mean, maybe it's looking in retrospect that this seems so ridiculous, and maybe it didn't look as much like this at the time, but a drama like that movie that occurs all on a soundstage, no special effects, the fact that it could range in budget from 33 to 70 million is just...
Yeah.
Stunning to me. It's like, how could you spend $70 million on a soundstage movie?
That's all talent. That's all star salary. You have David Fincher, Leonardo DiCaprio, Scarlett Johansson, all getting something close to their full freight. I mean, if you're paying $20 million for DiCaprio, right there, right? That's all of a sudden. That's more than a quarter of the money. So. The actual cost of making the movie, like renting the stages, getting the cameras, hiring grips and everything, that doesn't change. The variable is 100% the cost of the talent. And if you make it with expensive A-list talent, you can easily spend $70 million. If you make it with low-cost talent like Michael Fassbender, all of a sudden it's a $30-something million movie.
And Universal wound up making it for much less and still lost.
That's much money, exactly right, because that's the problem with these types of movies. Even if you make it for less, you can vary the production cost. You can't really vary the marketing cost that much. If you're going to open a movie nationwide, it still costs minimum 25 or 30 million, easily 40 or even 50 million to open the movie nationwide and get attention. And it doesn't matter if it's a tiny movie like Steve Jobs or a huge movie like, say, Ready Player One, the marketing budget can vary, but not a lot. So it's still easy to lose a lot of money. And when the movie's a flop like Steve Jobs, you can lose significant amounts of money, which Universal did.
How well is Sony making the transition now to the franchise era? I guess they'll have Venom coming out this summer. We'll find out what a Spider-Man movie without Spider-Man looks like.
Yeah, they're definitely on their way. I mean, the big marker for them, Spider-Man Homecoming, right, but they didn't make it. The big point of pride over there these days is the Jumanji sequel, right? Jumanji Welcome to the Jungle has just been a monster hit. I mean, it's grossed $944 million worldwide. Totally revived that franchise, obviously well set up for sequels. So this is the biggest franchise Sony's had in-house since Spider-Man started, and they didn't entirely own Spider-Man. So given that they own Jumanji, it's their biggest one maybe ever, certainly up there, maybe since Men in Black back in the day. So that's been a monster hit for them. That's they're definitely turning the corner somewhat. But they're nowhere close to being where, you know, Disney and Warner Brothers are. They have Spider-Man, and Jumanji in terms of major franchises. That's it. But certainly Tom Rothman, who took Amy's job, is very much trying to help them, get there. And he's got several bets coming up, including, as you mentioned, Venom.
Right. Is there an obvious explanation for why Dwayne Johnson's Jumanji did so well and why his Baywatch for Paramount, I guess. Was that a Paramount film?
Yeah.
Why it did so poorly? I mean, it doesn't make a lot of sense. I mean, one's a children's movie, I guess, is the most obvious difference.
Right. I mean, look, Dwayne Johnson is the biggest movie star in the world right now, without a doubt. I would probably argue Baywatch would have grossed a lot less than $178 million worldwide it did without Dwayne Johnson. I think it would have been nothing.
I saw Star Wars The Last Jedi on an IMAX, and it's probably the only really good theater experience I've had in the last several months. I saw Black Panther mm-hmm. at an older theater, and I just kept thinking the whole time with the kind of fuzzy transfer and not great audio that I can't wait to see this at home. I mean, do you think have the theater chains, would they be in better shape if they had modernized, or would it just add more debt to the problems?
No, they are aggressively modernizing. I mean, there's more, I don't know what it's like where you live, but all across the country, the big chains like AMC and Regal are aggressively investing in their remodeling theaters where they tear out all the old seats. They put in these kind of luxury reclining seats. There's fewer seats in the theater. You might go from 150 seats to 100, and then they charge more for every seat. It becomes more of a luxury experience because, you know, people are going to the movies less these days. And when they go, they want something that's better than their home. So exactly to your point, the theaters are aggressively trying to make their auditoriums better than what you've got at home.
Is that working?
Charging more for it. Yes, it's working somewhat. It's working in that they're making more money. Like people, because they're basically them throwing up their hands and saying people are not going to go to the movies more. Like, we can't just make that happen. So when they come, we're going to charge them more, and we're going to justify it. We'll make it more of a luxury experience. So it definitely is helping the bottom line of the movie theater companies.
Jamie Ehrlich and Zach Van Amberg, who ran the TV business at Sony, are now at Apple. I guess they've been there a year or so with a billion-dollar budget for a TV slate. We don't even know how those shows are going to be distributed yet. How do you think they'll be distributed?
My guess is that it's going to be, fundamentally, it's going to be, some kind of an add-on to a subscription, and a la Amazon Prime. And, you can imagine all sorts of opportunities. Obviously, Apple Music already exists. They could, you could add on something to that that costs a little bit more to add video. But also Apple's, there's been talk about, maybe an iPhone subscription where you pay Apple, I'm making this number up, but you pay Apple $20 a month. And then every year or every other year, you get the new iPhone, let's say, or a new iPad or whatever it is that you're into. And you can imagine part of that, you also get these great exclusive television series that you can watch on your Apple device, So I think, subscriptions are really taking over the business world. And you can see Apple getting into it in a variety of ways, including their hardware and or their music service. And video becomes an extra component of that that makes a subscription worthwhile, in the same way that, all the video on Amazon Prime is intended to make you feel like your Prime subscription is worthwhile. So you keep subscribing and you keep buying more stuff from Amazon.
Well, the Sony leaks gave you a lot of interesting material to start from, and you did a lot of, pretty phenomenal reporting around that to deepen and broaden the story. If there were one other company that had leaked material or that had material leaked around this time that would have made for a fascinating second book, which company do you think it would be?
Oh, it's just people have asked me that. No, one person asked me that, but you're privately, you're the first person to ask me in an interview. I think it's a good question. I have two answers. I'd say in terms of traditional Hollywood, I would say Disney for sure, right? Because they're the contrast to Sony. They've been in the lead on this franchise strategy, and it would be great to see how they've done it and to see how smart and how much foresight did they really have, and how much did they did they not realize what they have? And then sometimes companies don't realize what they're going to be so successful. And then once they succeed, they proclaim it was their intention and their vision all along, So if we had access to the Disney emails, maybe we could see how much did they understand really what they were doing while they were doing it. That would be fascinating. And how did they manage, the acquisitions of Marvel and Lucasfilm and all that and the integration? That'd be really interesting. The other company that would be Netflix. Netflix has, at this point in time, the mid-2000s, was aggressively moving into their streaming business. Since then, they've become, pretty dominant, right? They're putting out 700 pieces of original content this year. They're a dominant force in television. They're trying to become one in film. So getting insight into into their strategic decision making and their economics, you know, which are so opaque since they don't share very much economics and individual programs, would be fascinating.
Well, the book is called The Big Picture, and it's a really interesting read about what's happening in Hollywood right now. I appreciate you talking to me.
Thank you so much for having me.